Latter-day Saint Home Educators is pleased to bring you this audio presentation recorded live during the May 2006 Home Education Conference held at Southern Virginia University.
Hello, everybody. My name is Ariel Rodriguez. I'm a professor here at Southern Virginia University. I am the program coordinator for what's called the Family and Child Development Program. And so I'm a professor who has a background in human development and family relationships, right? I was asked to come up with something that would be more in my area of specialty, rather than necessarily something that I'd be making a stretch to try and reach. And I know a lot about parenting, and so I thought, well, I could talk about parenting, because when you're homeschooling, the reality is that a lot of things that happen are influenced by the family dynamics, the family relationships, the parenting that's going on. So I thought I would talk a little bit today about an issue that I guess I've been told that there was an interest in the past, which is the whole transition from dealing with children to dealing with adolescence. And so that's what I'm going to focus my comments on today. I'm going to talk a little bit about that transition. I'm going to talk about some of the differences between children and adolescence. And then we're going to try to get to the point where we talk about the implications of some of that. Introductions. First of all, I would like to just sort of to get us in the mood for what we're going to be talking about. I've asked my daughter, Soraya, to read an account that actually comes from real-life research. What you're going to hear is what a 15-year-old girl actually said in an interview when she was asked to describe herself. Okay? And so I want you to think about what this girl is saying and what it implies about her self-understanding, about who she is and the struggles she's going through. Okay, so here you go, Soraya. Take it away. Oh, well, let's put a mic on you. Hang on a second. Just hold it, maybe.
What am I like as a person? Complicated. I'm sensitive, friendly, outgoing, popular, and tolerant, though I can also be shy, self-conscious, and even obnoxious. I'd like to be friendly and tolerant all the time. That's the kind of person I want to be, and I'm disappointed when I'm not. I'm responsible, even studious now and then, but on the other hand, I'm a goof-off, too, because if you're too studious, you won't be popular. I don't usually do that well at school. I'm a pretty cheerful person, especially with my friends, where I can even get rowdy. At home, I'm more likely to be anxious around my parents. They expect me to get all A's. It's not fair. I worry about how I probably should get better grades, but I'm mortified in the eyes of my friends. So I'm usually pretty stressed out at home, or sarcastic, since my parents are always on my case. But I really don't understand how I can switch so fast. I mean, how can I be cheerful one minute, anxious the next, and then be sarcastic? Which one is the real me? Sometimes I feel phony, especially around boys. Say I think some guy might be interested in asking me out. I try to act different, like Madonna. I'll be flirtatious, fun-loving, and then everybody, I mean everybody, is looking at me like they think I'm totally weird. Then I get self-conscious and embarrassed and become radically introverted. I don't know who I really am. Am I just trying to impress them or what? But I don't really care what they think anyway. I don't want to care, that is. I just want to know what my close friends think. I can be my true self with my close friends. I can't be my real self with my parents. They don't understand me. What do they know what it's like to be a teenager? They still treat me like I'm still a kid. And at least at school, people treat you more like you're an adult. It gets confusing, though. I mean, which am I, a kid or an adult? It's scary, too, because I don't have any idea what I want to be when I grow up. I mean, I have lots of ideas. My friend Cheryl and I talk about whether we'll be stewardesses, teachers, or nurses. Veterinarians, maybe mothers, or actresses. I know I don't want to be a waitress or a secretary. But how do you decide all this? I really don't know. I mean, I think about it a lot, but I can't resolve it. There are days when I wish I could just become immune to myself.
Okay. Just a reminder.
Can we get a copy of that?
Do you want a copy of that? I guess I could make arrangements for that. Pass that one over to whoever said that, and we'll get more copies. But that, I mean, hopefully hearing that, you go, oh, I remember that. Yeah, that's called the confusion of early adolescence, right? Teenagers are really confused, right? They're not like you and I. They don't have, like, an integrated self. They have all this, you know, who am I, trying to figure things out. We're going to come back to that, but for now I just wanted to throw that out there just as a reminder to some of us who haven't been a teenager for a while about what some of that's like. Okay, anyway, who am I? I wanted to talk briefly and introduce myself. As I already said, I study family and child development, but I guess what I wanted to say was this is an LDS conference, and I want to reassure you that I'm really an LDS scholar. I put my faith before whatever kind of information is out there in the social sciences, and I really do believe that teaching is sacred work, right? Teaching is probably the most important part of parenting, and it's certainly the most important part of homeschooling, right? And it is sacred work. It is important stuff. So what we're talking about today, I think, is incredibly important. This isn't a church talk, though, and I wasn't asked to do that, so I'm not going to talk a whole lot about an LDS context. I'm going to talk about research information, but if you see insights, if things start firing off in your synapses and you see connections and you want to raise your hand and make comments, please do, okay? Anyway, again, who are you? I thought we'd all introduce ourselves, all three of us, but there's too many of you, so we'll move on. Overview. As I said, what I want to do is, first of all, we'll deal with parenting principles. I want to deal with things that hopefully you already know as parents. Okay, hopefully just to sort of lay some kind of a groundwork. Then I want to talk about the timing of that transition from childhood to adolescence. Then I want to describe how children change. And then finally, how parenting changes. And then finally, the implications for parenting and home education. And that's a lot to do in about, 40 minutes. So we'll see how far we get. First of all, what we already know about parenting. If you had to make a list of the top five principles that all parents need to know about raising children, what would you write? Think about that. I was going to have people actually write their list, but maybe what I'd like you to do is think of one thing and write it down. One important principle that you think all parents need to know.
When you were serving others.
Pardon me?
Patience.
Spoken like a true father. All right. Wait, good job. Any other thoughts? Go ahead. Okay, you don't have all the answers. That's a very good thought. Was there a hand over here?
Have fun with them.
That's great advice. I made a list, and this isn't like a definitive list, and this isn't even an expert's list. This is just me sitting down with 10 minutes or 15 minutes and trying to think of, based on everything I know about parenting, what do I think are the important things that parents need to know? And I actually didn't put it on your handout because I didn't want to bias your opinions, because I don't think that, when it comes to parenting, I want to support parents in their ideas about parenting. So maybe we could have these get passed around. You want to volunteer again? This is my lovely wife, Anne, who will be passing out the... No. Isn't she lovely? Okay. I'm going to just show you my list real quick. And you'll see that there's a lot of overlap with what's already been said. Let's go down here. Appendix. Yes, I called it an appendix because I didn't really want to deal with it in detail. But raising your children with love and righteousness. Right? Does anyone know where I stole those words? Proclamation on the Family, right. Love and righteousness. I think those are the two guiding thoughts that you need. You do need to love your children, and you do need to be able to control them and teach them how to control themselves, right? Point number two, open yourself up to influence, right? And that came through in a lot of the comments about listening to the Holy Ghost, understanding, going to the Scriptures, all that kind of stuff. Open yourself up to influence. Influence from your children. Influence from your spouse. Influence from Heavenly Father, right? Number three, I made a list of like 8 or 9, so you have to hear all mine. I apologize. Number three, beware your past, okay? Beware your past, because it is a truth that is just a part of the condition of this life that we tend to parent the way we were parented. And if there are bad things in our parenting past, we will carry them forward. So one of the things that you need to do in life is find a way to honor your parents and what they did. Sustain their parenting, whether that means making changes in your own parenting or continuing family traditions across generations. But that importance of realizing that you're not starting from a clean slate. You already have a whole lot of training about what it means to be a parent that you got from your own parents. Right. Next, most behavior problems, especially with young children and early adolescents, are really emotional problems. And if you try to treat them like a behavioral problem, you're doomed to failure, right? So an important part of parenting is talking with children about their emotions and understanding how those are influencing their behavior. You can disagree with me on any of these. I'm just throwing out what I think, just so you know where I'm coming from. If anyone asks parenting questions, this is going to be my bias as I answer them. Discipline is, and this is my definition of discipline, discipline is teaching. First and foremost, it's about teaching. And it's about teaching behavior and emotion. And there's one more thing that I forgot to add, which is the values that you have. Right? Behavior and emotion and values. I might have it farther down there somewhere, I don't know. But I think at the core of everything, that's what you're doing in parenting, right? So this particular bullet says, don't close down the emotion. Be an emotion coach. Again, most of this, I stole this from somebody else too. Somebody wrote a book about emotion coaching, which I thought was really insightful. In fact, the fellow's name is Gottman, if you're interested at all. In Gottman, G-O-T-T-M-A-N, John Gottman. It's a great book. And it talks about how you can help your children to understand their own emotions, particularly when they're young children. But it certainly applies to adolescents. Okay.
Is that what you mean by teaching emotions?
Well, here's the thing. I'm going to pick on mothers just for a moment, if I can, right? The reality of you have a newborn baby, right? What happens when baby gets emotion? Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Come on, let's be honest. Is it a good thing or a bad thing? Okay, but in your life, on a practical day-to-day basis, what happens if toddler or baby gets emotion, what does that mean for you?
Work
and trouble, right? And so moms, I'm not picking on moms on purpose, it's that there's research on this. If dads took care of kids, they'd probably do the same thing. But moms tend to, when emotion starts, they get real good at closing down the emotion, right? Soothing that baby, calming that baby, stopping that baby from emoting, right? And you get so good at that, you get very good at that. And if you don't eventually change your strategy, you're in trouble, right? Because then you've got a child who isn't free to emote and express and learn from their emotions. So at some point in those toddler years, you need to kind of change your focus and say, wait a minute, when this kid has emotions, that's an opportunity for me to teach them, right? Does that make sense? Go ahead. In appropriate ways, right? Right. I think there's ways to... I'm sorry, maybe I cut you off. Go ahead. Yes, and that's okay. And I'm not suggesting that you simply let emotions run wild. I guess though the question was, I got to talk to myself now. This is bizarre. But the question was, help me say into the mic what you just said. What was it? Just that you had a son who was having temper tantrums, and you let them go, and it didn't help any. And then you finally started disciplining him on the temper tantrums, and then that helped him, right? Yeah, and I agree with that. I'm not, it's particularly with boys. It's almost like boys and girls, there's different issues going on there. Because boys really do have to learn to, the real task of boyhood is controlling aggression, right? And that's a little bit different than the task of girlhood. You know, they've got different issues that they're dealing with in terms of emotion. So it's almost like a special boy issue, and it's probably, I don't want to go into all the details of it, but yeah, I agree with you now. The trick is sitting down with your son when he's feeling those feelings and talking with him about it and just simply helping him to learn from his experience. How are you feeling? You look like you're really upset to me. What do you, you know, you got a 3-year-old and you say, wow, how are you feeling? And he goes, I don't know. But you just say, gosh, you look really, really upset, angry. Yeah, I'm mad. What's bothering you? I don't know, I'm just mad. Gee, does it have anything to do with the fact that I just said you can't have your toy? I guess that's what, you know, and you help them to get insights and understanding about their emotions. That's kind of what Gottman's recommending in that book. It's more than anything, it's learning to put labels on emotions, learning to get insight about your own feelings and what causes them and how to deal with them. And if you just close down the emotion all the time, then kids don't get opportunities for that. Now, if you're teaching him how to control his own emotions, that's a good thing. That's a great thing. All right, I'm sorry. We have a comment.
Quick question. Okay. The mission of boyhood is to control aggression. What is it?
Girls don't necessarily have the same levels of testosterone, and they don't therefore have, and their amygdalas are smaller, and all kinds of new things are happening for them. So really, girls are really on the fast track to emotions. They're more able to recognize emotions and talk about emotions already and things like that. And if anything, the problem starts in early adolescence, which is regulating mood, right? Highs and lows and moody behavior, that's probably the bigger challenge. And it really doesn't start till later, and we'll get to that. So let's move on. I hit a bunch of buttons, or did they just show up? Sorry, I set this thing up so that it just automatically starts clicking things or something anyway. But here we go, there's more of these. Prevention is better and easier than intervention, right? It's easier to structure your home so that kids can't get into trouble than to fix all the troubles they get into, right? If you're not having fun, somebody already mentioned this, right? Being flexible, I think, is important. Don't get stuck in a rut. It's easy to do as a parent. Read to them as often as you can. I always have to put in a plug for reading because it is the most important thing you can do for kids to help their cognitive development, period. There's nothing else like it on the planet. The single most, the best predictor we have of how well kids do in public schools anyways is how many hours their parents read to them before they started school. That's the best predictor we have of how well kids do in public school. So you just can't, it's just important. And keep reading to them. You should be reading to your teenagers, right? Teach optimism. That's another one I think is important. Okay, so there's my, oops, that's not really the end of the slide. It's not over. Don't go home. hang on. Okay, so now we're going to go back to, so we did the principles thing. And I guess what I want to say is a lot of parenting doesn't change, right? A lot of the basics don't change. You still love your children. You still try to set rules and control and all that kind of stuff. But let's go on. The timing of the transition. When does a transition start? The important point here is that it sneaks up on you, okay? It sneaks up on you. You will not be thinking in terms of puberty. You'll just be noticing, gosh, my kids are getting cranky. They're getting frustrated. They're getting bored. They're getting aggressive. There's something wrong with them. And that's because, as it says here, the hormonal changes that influence their behavior happen before the outward signs of puberty, right? So they sneak up. I see a lot of women nodding their heads, a lot of people going, yeah, that happens. It sneaks up on you, right? It does. It sneaks up on you. Now, as far as specific ages go, these are averages. Girls, age 8 on average, that's when the hormones start happening that can start actually influencing their behavior. And I just, as a caveat, want to throw out that that's a national average. And if you look at married couples, their daughters tend to start puberty a little bit later. So maybe for some of you, the norm might be more like, 9 or 10 or later.
I've always wondered about that. I've noticed that.
There's lots of reasons. Okay, really quickly. First of all, stress and conflict will start puberty earlier. So usually when there's a breakup, there's been a divorce or something like that, that can trigger early puberty. Also, if there's a single parent mom who has a live-in boyfriend or something, they tend to have higher rates of conflict with the daughter than a dad would, right? So conflict will trigger it. Another issue is the pheromones of the non-biologically related male. Weird stuff, but basically, if you have a biologically related male living in the house with you, it triggers chemicals in your body that actually delay puberty. Whereas if you're living with a male, adult male, who's been through puberty and putting out the pheromones, and he's not genetically related to you, then your body starts puberty earlier. So when you look at what's happening there is the single parent families, really there's a boyfriend in there a lot of times, and the girl's exposed to that. It's really bizarre stuff. But anyway, let's go on. Boys, age 11. So girls do start earlier than boys. That's the transition. How they change. First of all, the puberty stuff. I'm not going to talk about puberty because I'm assuming you all got that like in eighth grade somewhere or something, right? The important thing is some of the changes that can happen to behavior. Girls typically, here's their changes. This is typical. Not all girls do this. And some girls change differently depending on, how much testosterone they have or things like that. But generally, girls can become moody and irritable. Right? Some of you have already been there and you go, yes, my daughters. I remember when my daughters started that whole moody and irritable thing and I just thought, oh my goodness. Wow. Even when you know it's coming, it's just surprising.
Measured by how many gallons of tears they shed.
Yeah, yes, exactly. Okay, girls tend to spend less time alone once all these hormones start affecting them. They're getting estrogen and they're getting oxytocin. They're getting these chemicals that make them want to connect with other people and they want to have friends and they almost become like hypersocial and needy in that sense, right? Some of you hopefully are like laughing with me instead of at me, right? Boys, the typical changes. Boys become more aggressive or irritable because the main chemicals they're getting are, the girls are getting an increase in testosterone, right? They're getting that too. But the boys are getting a much more dramatic increase in testosterone, and they're getting none of those chemicals that are about connection and relationship. So one of the things that you see happening with boys is they actually want to spend more time alone, right? Boys kind of withdraw into their bedroom and started wanting to just sit around and they can become less communicative and all kinds of things like that, right? Those are common sort of experiences. Right? Yeah, well, there's privacy issues and there's all kinds of things that are happening too. But yeah, that can happen. Girls, I'm just saying these are the general trends, right? Okay. How they change, more stuff. Psychological reactions to the physical changes. So not necessarily puberty, but the reactions to the puberty. What do earlier adolescents like the least about themselves? If you've had any teenagers, you know this, right? They get very concerned about the changes that are happening to their body. And so when you ask in an open-ended survey where they have all kinds of options to talk about, the first thing that comes to their mind is, you know, I don't like my weight, or I don't like my skin, or I don't like my hair. I got one daughter who's just got almost all those things covered. You know, she's just got all kinds of things that, you know, she doesn't like about herself. Girl problems associated with these reactions. Okay, first of all, early maturing girls. Now this is, I hope, a function of the public school system, and you won't have to deal with this. What happens to early maturing girls in public schools is because you mature earlier, you attract attention from older boys, right? And you end up being accepted into the older kids' clique. So you might only be 13, but you're hanging around with 16 and 17-year-olds, and you're being exposed to temptations and, you know, drugs or alcohol or sex or all those kind of things that are really older kids' things. And the older kids are more cognitively developed and more mature and have a better chance of resisting those things and making better choices over those things. And it's these younger, early maturing girls that get all the problems. Right? So hopefully in homeschool, I'm guessing, I don't see why that would need to happen, because your kids hopefully wouldn't be suddenly hanging around older guys.
They may not be dealing with the same older kid issues because of that same dynamic.
Right. Okay. Yeah, plus hopefully you have more monitoring, yeah. Okay, another issue is for girls who and I'm not going to talk about self-esteem today because that's just a whole world of hurt for me and problems and stuff, but there's research, the important point is there's research showing that for girls who base their self-esteem on their body image, they're much more prone to depression, eating disorders, things like that. So then there's this concern here that you need to help your child to not be so focused on their body. Well, actually, that's the end stuff. We'll get to that. So intellectually, how do children change? They begin to think like adults. This is your child. Sometime after 8, your child starts developing a really dramatic capacity for abstract thinking, right? Abstract thinking facilitates thinking about thinking. And that's what turns them into teenagers, right? That's what turns them into teenagers. They're suddenly spending a lot more time thinking about things that they never thought about before, right? So, for example, increased introspection, concern for the future, idealism, impatience with the present, all these kind of things start happening as a result of that abstract thinking, right? Here's the big issue. Okay. And I left it blank on your handout because I didn't want the answer to be there. I do this to my students in my presentations. I leave blanks all over the place and they have to like pay attention and stay awake. You guys all look kind of awake, but anyway, what do you consider to be the developmental task of adolescence? What do you think is the big picture, the big issue that teenagers, okay, and not necessarily, you got to stop for a moment and think, okay, what I'm talking about is child development experts. What would they say is like the big issue that teenagers are trying to deal with in adolescence? Autonomy, independence. Those are good thoughts.
Acceptance.
Okay, I'm gonna throw out the word here just because we don't have a lot of time. Identity development is the big issue that they're trying to deal with. They're trying to create an identity for themselves. That's the task. That's the business of adolescence, right? Oh, go ahead.
That's why you have Green, Gary, Eric,
Stone. Yes, exactly. Yes, yes. Because here's the thought. This is almost like crazy thinking, right? But it's like, gee, in order to be myself, I have to be different than other people. That's almost like their first step towards identity, right? In order to be myself, that means I have to be different than mom and dad. I guess I'll dye my hair green, right? makes a lot of sense, yeah. Okay, so abstract thinking leads to a heightened self-awareness, and that leads to increased self-doubt, and that leads to eventually self-integration. That's the task, right? Creating an integrated self, an integrated identity. This is who I am, right? The story that I had my daughter read is a story about a 15-year-old girl who does not yet have that integration. She's all over the place. She doesn't know who she is. She's literally different people with different people, right? That's the early part of adolescence. Go ahead.
At what point is it normal that this resolves?
The late adolescence. And we're going to say the difference between middle and late is somewhere around 15, 16. So it's one of those, this too shall pass. These kids will eventually get this integration stuff happening, right? Okay, let's go on. How they change, their self-understanding, okay? Now, this specifically is about that little segment that my daughter read. Here's some of the ways in which their views of their self-understanding is different than you and I. And this, I think, is very helpful to you when you're trying to get into your kid's head and try to understand the things they're dealing with. Remind yourself that they don't even have a self yet. They're still working on that, and it's a struggle, and it's a stress for them, right? So they're more abstract and idealistic in their self-understanding. They'll come up with these big generalities and these big abstract kind of concepts to describe themselves, right? And at the same time, their self-understanding is, compared to how they were in childhood, their self-understanding becomes more complex and more confusing. So, for example, they will, for the first time, sense contradictions in their sense of self, right? I'm this way with my parents, I'm this way with my friends, and that is unsettling to them. It bothers them, right? So they'll experience those contradictions, that sense of a fluctuating self, that even with my parents, I'm this way sometimes, and I'm this way sometimes, and how could I be both, right? They have this differentiated self. That's the term, as opposed to integrated. In other words, they really can become like different people in different contexts. You throw them into a group setting versus in a one-on-one setting, and you could see two totally different teenagers, right? They have this differentiated self. They'll talk about the real me versus the fake me, right? Or the true me versus the false me, or whatever. They have this sense of, you know, sometimes I feel more real than other times. Sometimes I can tell I'm just acting. And sometimes it's really me. And they struggle with that, too.
I remember being in the equivalent of young women when I was a young teenager. And I remember they would always say...
Okay, so that's a good thought. Sometimes we say to young people, be yourself. But you need to be careful there because they don't really have a clear sense of self. And that might not be a good guide for them. Social comparisons. They start making social comparisons in a very big way, much more than you or I do. We adults do a lot of social comparison, but early adolescents do way more, right? In fact, here's this... they become hyper self-conscious. They're aware of every little thing that they're doing. They're aware of every little acne zit or whatever, all those little things, right? They become very, very self-conscious. Let's move on. How their emotions change. Their emotional life becomes more intense and more complex. That's a summary statement that maybe tells you nothing. I don't know. Their emotional variability resulting from concerns about how they appear to others. So they suddenly have these emotional moods and problems and issues because of how they come across to others. And you've seen that before. That's called embarrassment, right? That's that teenage daughter who doesn't want you to be dropping her off in front of her friend's house because they might see you in the car and all that. Yeah, those kind of things. So embarrassment becomes a really big issue to them at some point. Do you remember this? The imaginary audience? Do you remember that? Some of you are already laughing. This is like when you're a teenager and you almost like you feel like you're on stage and people are watching you and you're thinking, okay, how should I walk into the room and what exactly, how should I sit down and what, and how, you know, and you'll do things wrong sometimes and then you'll replay it in your mind afterwards. Okay, like, okay, I really said this and he did that and all. And it's almost like you're on a stage. Kids, that's how hypersensitive they are to their self and their self-monitoring, right? They have increased boredom, again, because they have that concern for the future. They have all these hormones that are saying, do something, and they're more aware of when they're suddenly not doing something and they're bored. Identity change. How does their identity change? Well, it doesn't happen all at once. Different identities develop at different times. Okay, and you're saying, what are different identities, Brother Rodriguez? People in the social sciences talk about your emotional identity, your religious identity, your social identity. There's all kinds of different identities. And so they'll be working on these different issues for a while. I have college students in SVU here who are 19 and 20, and I ask them, I give them a big long list of all these identity issues, and I ask them, are you still dealing with any of these? And they're checking them off. They're saying, yeah, I still don't really know who I am with respect to this or that or whatever, right? So it's something that's going to take a while. Developing healthy identities involves two things, according to at least a few researchers. First of all, this idea of exploring identity. Some researchers talk about it in terms of crisis. You have to at some point, and I guess the best metaphor for this, I want you to think about our own ideas about faith and finding your own faith and finding your own testimony. You can have been raised in a home where the gospel was there and the light of Christ was there, and you've had all kinds of experiences with the Holy Ghost witnessing to you. And still, you get these teenagers who are 15 or 16 and go to, especially for youth, and come back and say, you know, something changed. I prayed, I got an answer, I know this for myself now, right? They hit like a crisis point where they really said, I want to know this, and I want to really know this for myself. I want to have this, you know, this knowledge. And they hit that crisis, and then after that, the other part of it is making a commitment to that identity. Right? So this applies to all aspects of identity, not just religious identity, that these adolescents need to have experiences exploring identities. So you can't just be one of those parents who says, you're going to be a lawyer when you grow up, son, and you're going to do this and that. And, you know, that's not good for kids. They need to have the freedom to explore and come up with what they want. Right? Okay, so crisis and commitment, you saw that. Self-regulation is about impulse control and behavior control. And the important point I want to make here is this seems to be a critical period for the development of self-regulation in kids. Because what you find is from here on out, there seems to be this stability. When you look at people's ability to self-regulate, right around early adolescence, from there on, there's little change. If you've got someone who has poor impulse control when they're 13 or 14, it's likely that they're, as an adult, going to have poor impulse control. So this becomes an important time to really help your kids with that, with those issues, and help them to learn to self-regulate.
There's actually a study that was done at preschoolers by Howard Gardner.
Okay. So there's from what you're saying. Okay, I got to talk into the mic again. Mm-hmm. Okay. So the comment was that there was a study mentioned by Howard Gardner about how children, even in preschool, there's going to be some continuity between their ability to control their impulses and later adult impulse control. I'm sure that's true. What I'm trying to get at is when you look across the lifespan, the real strong stability really seems to start to happen right around early adolescence. Because in other words, you can do intervention with an 8-year-old kid and help them to learn impulse control. But it gets harder from this point on, from this early adolescence on, to help them to do that. And I think the issue there, here's my take on it. I think basically what happens is you get a new trick that you have to, a new hoop to jump through. You were able to regulate your behavior. Now you get a whole bunch of testosterone. Isn't that great, son? Now let's see if you can regulate your behavior, right? And so you need to be able to learn to jump through that new hoop. And if you can do that, you're set for life, right? Okay. So, yeah, you get the hormones, and then the issue is, can you still self-regulate? All right. And I already said that. It's relatively stable. Okay, let's go on. Time and activities. Here's what happens to teenagers. They spend less time with parents, typically speaking. That's going to happen. They're going to have friends and peers and want to do stuff. They're going to become social. They spend more time with peers, particularly. Now, here's an interesting bit of research. Teenagers are more likely to spend more time with peers when their parents insist on retaining power and control, high levels of power and control, and when their parents refuse to share decision-making, basically not giving kids choices, not giving them freedom. And I'm talking about not total freedom, just freedom within bounds. You know, start sharing more of the discipline and the responsibility and stuff and putting things on them. How are you going to fix this? You messed up here, son. What do you think you should do about it, right? Okay. They spend more time alone, right? And they get concerns about privacy. That's part of it. And part of it is just that they want to be alone and think and things like that. Their media choices change, which is some of you, I don't know how much freedom you give your children with media, but if you do give them freedom, a lot of freedom with media, what you'll find is that they start watching less TV and spending more time listening to music. That's one of the signs that your child's turning into a teenager, right? Peer relationships. Negative peer pressure increases in early adolescence. It's probably at an all-time high. This is as bad as it gets for them, okay? So if whether it's at church or at school or anywhere, if they're going to be exposed to negative peer pressure, this is probably about as bad as it's going to get for them. I would have to say that that's probably the case for my kids, even at church. With kids and the scouts and all that kind of stuff, the pressure to do things that were wrong was probably the greatest when my son when he was in that early adolescence phase. Right, friendships are the thing that buffer kids against negative peer pressure. Okay, so friendships are good. So when you look at their peer relationships, what you find is the peer group a lot of times isn't necessarily. Now, hopefully, all of us as LDS people, we can kind of help to create positive peer groups for kids. Right, and that's important. We do that through church and we do that through play groups and things like that. But again, this is like, I guess, kids in public school system and things like that. There's a lot of negative pressure, and it's the kids who don't have friends who take the biggest hit from that pressure, have the hardest time dealing with it. Go ahead.
Is it important that these friends be long-term over?
Yeah. That's hard. I mean, anytime you throw a kid into a new school or something or a new area, then the issue becomes they have to operate in the peer group, right? They have no choice because they're at church and there's a bunch of other kids there. They're in the neighborhood. There's other kids there. And if they don't have the friendship, if they don't have the friends in place, it's just a burden for them. And so anything you can do to facilitate friendships for them as soon as possible, I mean, that's the implication there, is that they really do need friendships. And if not, then maybe at some point in there, you got to think about protecting them from the peer group pressure. Talking, being more active as a parent, more involved, discussing with them what's happening, what kind of things are you, do kids bug you, are there any issues, things like that. Okay. For girls.
But in some ways, that becomes a loop because the more.
Yeah, because the identity thing, they want to be away from you to find their identity, and you're trying to pull in and they're trying to pull out, and yeah, you're right. That's a real challenge.
Advice,
yeah.
But it may work and it may not.
Right.
It may backfire.
Yeah. And that's probably a good thought, is if at any point you're trying to pull them in, starts to create resistance in them, watch out, you know, because that's how you create rebels, right? Let's go on. For boys, friendships, okay, so for girls, friendships buffer them against internalizing problems, right? Mm-hmm. So girls that have friends are less likely to be depressed. They're less likely to have, you know, negative thoughts, eating disorders, things like that. Boys that have friendships are less likely to do the externalizing things like get into trouble with the law or violent, aggressive behavior or risk-taking behavior, things like that. Go ahead. Boys do, yeah. Again, these are the generalizing trends. If you look at the kind of behavior problems that kids develop in early adolescence, you see this really strong pattern, which is that girls tend to develop internalizing problems and boys tend to develop externalizing problems. But there's certainly boys who have depression or, you know, become suicidal or, you know, all kinds of things can happen to them. Yeah. I guess the point is, all I meant by that bullet was that there's clear research showing that friendships do this for the boys. Now, whether it buffers them from internalizing problems, there's not good research to speak on that issue because there's not enough studies that have been done on boys with internalizing problems. Okay. Do or should parents lose control over the children's lives as their children develop into adolescence? Don't answer that. Okay. Do or should parents lose influence over their children's lives as their children develop into adolescence? Don't answer that yet. The third one, here we go. Who has the stronger influence in adolescents' lives, parents or peers? Peers, you're all saying peers. Okay. Parents, you're all saying parents, okay. Oh, good, all right. Public service announcements are working, that's great. Okay, you had a comment? It certainly would. Overall, the pattern that you see, okay, so here's the fill in the blank. This is the one actually where you had the fill in the blank, right? Parents, as compared to peers, retain greater influence over the things that matter most. That's the clear summary that you can make from research. In other words, can you have influence over whether or not your daughter decides that she wants to dye her hair green? You probably have less influence over that than can you influence your daughter to marry in the temple? Can you influence your daughter to have your same value system? Can you influence your daughter to avoid drugs? Things like that. The big issues, the ones we care about the most as parents, are the ones where we actually have the greater influence than the peer group. It's the more superficial issues that where the peer group tends to have a strong influence. And that, again, would be parents who haven't abdicated their responsibility as parents. Because sometimes parents hit adolescence and go, oh, yeah, it's all the peers now. They don't even listen to me. What can you do as a parent? And they give up, right? But parents who are still in there and stay involved and do their job end up having an incredible influence over children's values and their life choices, right? So that's the important issue. And so what I wanted to try and sell you on was the idea that as a parent, maybe it's going to be a good thing to actually lose some control over your child as they become a teenager. They need to start having self-control, right? But you shouldn't be losing influence, certainly over the important things that matter, right? That's your goal. Your goal is to be the person that they listen to. You're the wise, older, knowing parent, right? And they're going to look at you and come to you for advice and listen to you, hopefully, because that's your strength, right? We had a hand over there.
I was just going to say, you know, sometimes during those teenage years, we feel like we've lost control, but that influence, and by the time they're 22, 24, they look back and...
Yeah, and they go, Mom wasn't so stupid. Wow. You know, I remember having those thoughts, thinking, gosh, my parents got a lot smarter. That's like a Mark Twain quote or something, isn't it? Yeah, that's somewhere in there, yeah. Yeah. I remember having that experience, and I hadn't even read Mark Twain. There you go. Okay, so how parenting changes? Oh, gosh. I got like 3 minutes here. I'm going to go quickly. It's not going to happen. Increase parent-child conflict. Okay, there is greater conflict typically when kids become teenagers. It's perceived by the child more so than by the parent. So you might have a child who is one of these boys who wants to be in there alone and wants to, you know, I want to be in my room alone, I want to disengage, right? But he's still experiencing the interaction with you as conflict. even though you see it as, oh, he's just not talking to me now, and he just walks off and things like that, right? So, yeah, there is increased conflict. It causes more stress to the child than the parent, right? So the issue there is it generally stresses, kids report more stress from parent-child conflict than the parents do. Mothers bear the burden of disagreements. I'm sure you all know that. They become more emotionally reactive as a result of that, which is something that you have to watch out for. Again, I'm not trying to pick on mothers. I'm just trying to describe the reality of what happens. Fathers tend to withdraw from disengagements when mother is present, which is not a good, I'm not saying that's a good thing, but that's a pattern that you see. Men in general tend to withdraw from verbal conflict, right? It helps them to sort of survive the verbal conflict. So if there's verbal conflict going on, mom engages and dad pulls out. That's a pattern. Here, look.
Yeah. Aren't you going to say something?
Yeah.
And he doesn't, and I'm like, okay, now my choice is, I've got a child here, and he needs to hear something from a parent.
Yeah.
You know, and it causes conflict between my husband and I because I get mad at him for not stepping in. So if you've got those patterns and you're supposed to watch out for them, what do you do about it?
Okay, first of all, that's a really good 45-minute talk, which I would love to do sometime. But for now, what I would say is obviously you need to be working with your husband. You need to talk to him about the issue. And the main strategy I would suggest you try to sell him on is sometimes when you are up there with your emotions that you're going to say, honey, it's time for you to take over, and you leave the room. You know, just let him do it on his own without you there supervising or being involved in it or anything. Just like, you're in charge now, I leave the room. When I get back, you tell me what you came up with, right?
You need to agree on that ahead of time.
Right, yeah, ahead of time. You're trying to sell, that's what I'm saying. You sell him on that idea, and if you can sell him on that idea, that's my number one advice to you. And if that doesn't work, then like write me an email and I'll give you more advice. But that's the main thing I try to sell you on. So fathers withdraw. Now here's the other thing about fathers, right? When mom's not present, fathers are more open and interactive with their kids. They can do some pretty good parenting when mom's not there, because the issue is they tend to withdraw. But if mom's not there, then they will do some of that stuff. Go ahead.
Oftentimes, though, it happens. We had a home teacher who worked with church social services to deal with.
Right, exactly. And he's going to know that, right? He's going to know, I got to report back to my wife when this is all over. So, yeah, exactly. Okay. All right. Now the issue becomes, do I carry on the sins of the past generation? Because the last presentation went over, and I'm going over. I think I'm supposed to be done by 2:35, right? And there's nobody here really to cut me off. It's just you guys getting up and walking out that would stop me, right? Anyway, but you guys have handouts, and at least on there somewhere you have all kinds of ideas about how to make things work. Maybe, okay, just quickly, let's go to the stuff about what are the implications of this stuff. Forget about the implications. Don't get taken by surprise. You can figure that out, right? Information and preparation about puberty reduces children's anxiety and worrying about puberty. So you should be teaching your children in your homeschool about puberty and all the changes and all that kind of stuff. Be careful about how you discuss your body and their body in front of them. Don't be one of those parents who says, oh, I'm way too fat. No, don't be negative about your body because they'll pick it up, right? Engage them in abstract thinking, critical thinking. And I've got those are the core critical thinking skills. If you don't know what they are, there's a good website on critical thinking, and they have it's a guy named Fashion, who has a website all about critical thinking and research on critical thinking. But this is the time to engage them in that stuff, especially boys. It's a good way to engage them. It's hard to engage them emotionally, but you can engage them with critical thinking. I don't know that it's, I know the document is by a guy named Fashion, like F-A, it's Italian, S or C, I-O-N-E or something like that. And it's about critical thinking. Just email me and I can send it to you. It's a PDF on a website about critical thinking. If you Google it, I'm sure you'll find it. Turn discipline into problem solving. Okay, so this is another way to take advantage of their abstract thinking. Turn every discipline issue that you have with them into a problem solving critical thinking task. Okay, son, I got this problem. I'm your parent and you're not listening to me and I can't figure out what to do. Let's work on this. Can you help me solve this problem? Right? And you use those kind of strategies. It helps them to start thinking. Okay? Allow them and encourage them to explore identities as long as they don't violate your family values, right? That's your only concern. Anything that doesn't violate your family values, they're good to go. You should let them explore it and go with it, right? Create and adapt family traditions that keep them in your life. Because again, we said we didn't say it. We skipped that part. Kids will get busy with their own schedules, right? They're teenagers. They have friends and all that kind of stuff. avoid conflict. Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll end it. I feel bad. People are walking out. So, anyways, thank you very much for coming. If you have any questions about any of that stuff, email me or something. Oh, I'm sorry. arodriguez@southernvirginia.edu. So you got to write out A, and then it's R-O-D-R. Oh, it's on there. You guys have it. I forgot. And you got to write out the whole thing. Southern Virginia. .edu. And so if you have questions about stuff on the handout or something, I'm still on the mic. Yikes. Okay. All right. And then when you send me the email, at least reference this presentation or I won't even know what's going on. Thank you very much.
LDS Home Educators is a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization dedicated to providing inspiration to homeschool families. We hope you enjoyed this recording. If you are interested in listening to more recordings or would like to participate in a future conference, please visit our website at ldshe.org.